Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Alchemy of Light broadcast. I'm Jamil Graham, your host, and I'm so grateful and honored to be welcoming to today's show, PMH Atwater. Hello, PMH.
Hi there.
How are you doing today?
Well, I'm ready. I'm absolutely ready to go.
That is fantastic, and I am as well. We are here today to discuss her new book, Near-Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story, what they teach us about living, dying, and our true purpose. And PMH, you have a very rich and colorful history in the near-death experience community and near-death experience research. You are a near-death experiencer yourself. And I would like you to please introduce yourself to the listeners who, if you could give us in brief, a general synopsis of your story to this point that brought you to this book for all the listeners that might not have followed your work to this point.
Well, you're asking for days of material, so let me just do little snippets. I died three times in 3 months in 1977, and later that year, that was twice in January, once in March, and later that fall, I had three major relapses, one of which was adrenal failure. I was working at the time with a blood pressure reading of 60 over 60. Which means I wasn't doing too good. What a lot of people seem to forget when they talk about near-death experiences is that most of them come from trauma or violence. So you've got a body to rebuild when you're through, when you come out of the episode. And I certainly did. I had to relearn how to crawl, how to stand, how to walk, how to run, how to climb stairs, how to tell the difference between right and left, how to see properly, hear properly, and rebuild all of my belief systems. So number one for me was just being a human being again, you know, being able to walk on two legs with eyes right focused ahead and just, you know, proceed in life. And that was hugely big. And when I came back, the world didn't make any sense. My life didn't make any sense. Being a human being didn't make any sense. And so my way of dealing with that was to challenge everything in my environment. I challenged soap and sheets and food and pots and pans, you name it. I challenged it. I had to investigate it. I had to study it. Was this really what I wanted in my life? What was it in that soap, or what was that in the sheets that was helpful or not helpful? And with pots and pans, I even went so far as to send off to all the major manufacturers of pots and pans to get their metallurgical reports and manufacturing specs. And then I took those to a lab in downtown. And I had them tested, and only on the basis of those reports I received from that lab did I make my decision about what pots and pans to have in my home, which meant that I threw away everything aluminum. I threw away everything that had a copper bottom. I threw away anything that was sort of pre-greased. You know, I don't know quite how to describe that, this coating that they put on things like frying pans where
Teflon
you don't have to grease them.
Stuff?
Yeah, all of that. All of that was thrown away because it did not pass the lab reports. Yeah, I didn't want that in my home. It was not healthy. It was not safe. I didn't want it. And I don't care what the people tell you. I had this stuff tested, and it flunked. So I brought into my home stainless steel and some other and very fine stainless steel, tinned steel, and various other types of pots and pans I had never used before, but I was certainly using it now. So, you know, I was, you know, I
what made
price
the grade? Not to distract you, but that's very interesting that the NDE.
I do use Faberware, but I do not use any Teflon coated Faberware. Fortunately, I was able to buy some before they converted to that type of frying pan. So I consider what I have to be fabulous. And then tin steel, it's fabulous for baking. It's so much better than aluminum pans that there's no comparison. But moving right along, I was doing that with everything. I was tossing stuff, you know, I mean, it was funny, actually. But it enabled me then to rebuild my life in a more healthy and a more conscious and in a more reasonable and loving way. I just would not live the old... Well, I couldn't. I couldn't live the old way anymore. And fortunately, in September this year, September 2 through 4 in Durham, North Carolina, IANS is going to be holding their yearly conference. Only this time, they're going to allow me on September 1, which is Thursday, to give a special workshop on some of the things that I learned after I died in order to be a reasonable human being. And I'm going to go into the discoveries I made about wearing your body and using your mind. So anybody who wants to get kind of deeply into some of the things I learned in order to be a human being again, then be sure you sign up for that workshop September 1 in Durham, North Carolina. It will be 1 to 5 in the afternoon. So I'll finally be able to share some of that. I've been trying to for years. I can share it all over the country, but I've never been able to share it with near-death experiencers. And that's the group I especially wanted to touch and couldn't. They could never seem to arrange it in their conferences. But this year they are. So I'm very happy. Of course, it's for anybody, but I'm especially interested in that. So, I was one of those more radically affected by their near-death experience. Experiences 2 and 3 were very long and complex. So I was one that just, it really, really, really turned my life around big time. And what made a difference for me also was in my third near-death experience, I reached the realm that we in research call the realm of all-knowing. You know, it's where a lot of experiencers go there. That's where you get all the revelations, all your questions are answered, like, why did Uncle Bill lose his arm in World War II? You know, all these kinds of things are put right. You know, why is there so-called evil in the world? What is evil? You know, all these questions are answered for most people. And I reached there, too. And while I was there, I heard a voice speak. Now, Jamil, this wasn't like us speaking with a voice. It was a voice that was so big and so powerful and so thunderous that it's like it filled the entire universe. I mean, it was that big. And that voice said, and I quote, "Test revelation. You are to do the research. One book for each death." It named books 2 and 3, not book 1. It showed me what all this meant, what was to be in each book. It did not tell me how to do it or how long this project would take me. And I accepted this mission, my orders, got my working papers, and when I revived, because, you know, that first year just had to be a human being again, and then begin my work the next year, 1978, and really began it after I met Dr. Elizabeth Kubler-Ross at O'Hare Airport, just outside of Chicago. She was on her way to Europe. The plane was late, and it was an hour late. And I was there, recognized her, went up to her, and we sat down on a little bench and started talking like a couple of little schoolgirls. And we talked the whole hour. And she wanted to know about my experience, so I told her. And she's the one who said that it was a near-death experience. Never heard that term before. That was the first time I'd ever heard the term. And that I was a near-death survivor. She did not call me an experiencer. She called me a survivor. And that was it. She never mentioned Raymond Moody. She never mentioned the book Life After Life. And I never heard of those. You know, when I began my work, it wasn't until I'd been doing this for maybe about 4 years before I ever heard of Ray. Well, it was Ken Ring. It was Ken Ring who introduced me to the work of Raymond Moody and the book Life After Life. You know, I just had no idea who that person was. So I was doing my own thing because that's what I was told to do. You know, I didn't know anything about the classical pattern. You know, I didn't have any of that to direct me. I did not know that anybody else was researching it. You know, I was just doing my own thing all by myself. And I was a cop's kid. I was raised in a police station. So I used what Dad taught me in the way of police investigative techniques as my protocol because I was familiar with it and because there was no way in this world I would ever use questionnaires. Dad was very specific about that. You never, never, never use a word in advance of the experiencer or the you know, witness or, you know, the individual. You never use a word in advance. In other words, if there's like a big accident, all you can say to the witnesses is, did you see anything? And if they say car, then you can say car.
Right.
If they say crash, then you can say crash.
May I just sort of interrupt you and back up just a little? Because you are saying something that I think is really universal and really significant for all human beings. And that is that in your healthy, normal life process of evolving, you had a very profound experience that affected you on such a deep level that it radically changed your whole perception of who you were, who you were not, right down to the pots and pans you could use in your kitchen. Okay,
yep.
And the messages were so profound that it set you on a whole new life course.
Right.
And all of this happened before the word near death even occurred to you. Is that correct?
Correct.
Okay. So then you organically, as a human being that wants to do good in the world, as most people do, began your journey exploring and expanding on the mission that you had been handed, correct?
Well, let's be clear here.
Okay.
I did not do this to do good in the world.
Okay.
I did this because I was told to.
Okay.
By the voice like none other.
Okay. You chose to do that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I chose to accept what I was told to do.
Yes, okay.
I didn't
thank
make
you.
A conscious choice to do it in the sense of I'm going to be a researcher.
Mm-hmm.
You know, anyone who makes a conscious choice to be a pioneer researcher, as far as I'm concerned, is nuts. I mean, they got to be crazy. Because this is tough stuff, dear. we're talking 33 years ago. Anyway, I did it because I was told to do it by a voice, by a presence, by a power that so held me and filled me, I felt like I had no other choice.
Okay. And then you began the journey and had the fantastic synchronicity of encountering Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who is one of the most, well, one of the things that I know about her is she revived the conversation of hospice and the whole conversation of death and dying here in America. And that's how I know of her work. So if you were going to talk to one person, the creator had a pretty good idea who they did it.
Yeah, it was pretty neat that I bumped into her.
Yes. And then you began the research as following your own innate ability. And then so at this point, all these years later, you've encountered some challenges in being a researcher and some challenges in integrating this in your life. And what I understand is one of the challenges that you immediately hit on when you began to share your research was that it did not jive with the mainstream model that existed. And this has been a source of challenge for you. Is that correct?
Oh, that's got to be the understatement of the year.
Okay.
It caused all kinds of trouble.
This did. Okay. Then, you know, I want to offer you this platform to clarify for all of us because, you know, I am, in a funniest way, a child of a near-death experiencer who, like yourself, really never heard of Raymond Moody until after pretty close to Mum's departure. I learned about the near-death experience through experience myself. So I'm much identified with you and your path, and I believe there are a lot of humans that are like us in that we really are just wanting to understand the profound experiences that we go through. We really want to understand how to integrate the voices that we hear, honor the ones that are speaking to us from a holy place, if you will, you know, just to use a word of sacredness. And then we also meet these challenges of, well, we don't fit in the boxes that are out there. And for some reason, the people who run these boxes have a lot of energy to attack us and make our life miserable if we let them. And so what you're speaking about, I feel like a lot of us are kind of just coming into, and I want to, would you please explain to us in the conversation of the near-death experience, how would you define the classic model and then put it side by side by your model? And my intention here with the Alchemy of Light broadcast and everything that I'm doing with my work is to provide a platform where we expand our conversation with tolerance and respect, because there's room for every kind of research.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's room for every kind of angle that we can approach this from. And the more we learn to listen to each other and share openly with our hearts and our minds, with the innocence of our child within, to really learn and to really grow, which is really innate in all of us, the better we'll all be. So if I can be of service in this broadcast and in anything I do and opening the conversation, I will have accomplished what I'm being told to do.
That's good. That's good. I think it'd be really good, first of all, to take a look at what the near-death experience is, to define it, first of all.
Okay.
And I really prefer the definition that is done by IANS, the International Association for Near-Death Studies.
Okay.
They define it this way. The near-death experience is an intense awareness, sense, or experience of otherworldliness, whether pleasant or unpleasant, that happens to people who are at the edge of death. It is of such magnitude that most experiencers are deeply affected, many to the point of making significant changes in their lives afterward because of what they went through. So that's IANS definition. Raymond Moody's basic model And I'm not really going to quote the whole model. You'd have to, you know, look at your Google it or get on the internet or get in various books. But it's basically the person leaves their body, that they go through this long dark tunnel. They head toward a light at the end of the tunnel, and they are met by loved ones who've died and gone on before them, or a greeter of some kind, and that there can be some kind of dialogue, and then they are loved. They are incredibly loved. They're able to view their life as meaningful. Some of them have a life review, not all of them. And there's just so much emotions, so much feeling, this sense of sacredness of God, and then they come back. And some come back through the tunnel, some don't. And then afterward, most of them lose their fear of death, and they become more charitable, more giving, more loving, become basically a happier or more satisfied person. And many of them very, very devoted to service, wanting to serve others, help others. They lose that ego-centeredness of me first, or, you know, I want to be really ambitious. I'm going to be the top person in the corporate management. I'm going to make $1 million. It's like that no longer has that kind of meaning. So that basically is what he put out. Although, you know, there's a lot of steps to that. That's basically what he put out. I found something kind of different. The basic pattern of the experience, yes, that's true, and it's true globally. But the elements in the pattern differ with most people. What we know today is, and what I found out right away, hardly anybody then, very few now, experience a tunnel. That you can trace back reports of the tunnel to when the media sensationalized Raymond Moody's first book. Mm. And that's when the tunnel became popular. It was not popular before then. Gallup polled their first scientific survey of people who'd had near-death experiences. That was done in 1982. Only 9% of the people reported a tunnel. Mm. So that's, you know, children and adults do experience that, but basically it's a myth. A myth in the sense that it's really part of the pattern, because it's not. It's sort of like an extra feature that some people can indeed experience. What I found was that there were basically four different arrangements of that pattern. One of them I call the initial experience. That's very short. Something like the loving nothingness, the friendly dark, a greeter of some kind, maybe a voice, maybe a quick in and out of body experience, like maybe one or two of those, three max. And a lot of kids have that, a lot of children. Well over 70% of the children in my research base had that. And adults can have it too, of course. But it's mostly kids that have that one. Then the unpleasant or hellish experience. Yes, I did find a fair amount of those in my research base, 1 out of 7. And there are other researchers in the field who found more. I truly believe that it could easily be 1/3 of them have that kind. But these people won't report it, won't talk about it. I think the only reason that I found so many is because I too was an experiencer, and they trusted me, So they'd come up and talk about their experience. And about a third of those who had that type of experience had something like the Hollywood version, you know, torture chambers, gargoyle-like beings, you know, pain, being ripped apart, thunderous weather, you know, this kind of thing. But the other two-thirds reported something like being abandoned or lost in the void or being trapped in a vortex of some kind. So those were just a little bit different than that. These experiences are often very, not just unpleasant, but often distressing or frightening. Then there's the pleasant or heavenly experience. That's the one we hear the most about. That's most of the books are written about that one, TV, movies, articles, you know, that's the one most people talk about. And not even half the people in my research base had that, like 42% or something. Then there's the transcendent experience, and I call it that because it's usually very long, very complex. Very seldom is it personal. Once in a while you'll find someone who has a life review with it or finds out anything about their own family. Usually it has to do with the collective, that is to say the human family, not just your family, history, what can be done to make changes, specific changes or certainly meaningful ones with the human family on Earth. So that tends to be, you know, that very larger, more collective view. So I got those four, and then I had got into very much the after effects and discovered a physiological and psychological pattern to the after effects. And a pattern to the integration, and, you know, I could go on and on and on with what I found and the difficulties with the after effects. Moody didn't find any difficulty at all with after effects, nor did Ken Ring. But I found lots of it. Divorce rate between 75% to 77%. Light sensitivity, sound sensitivity, electrical sensitivity. All kinds of things, and
possibly
nobody else had. But you know, the one thing, Jamel, that got me in trouble, and you'll get a kick out of this now, was I was very open with the fact that if you weren't psychic before, you became psychic after. If you were psychic before, you became very psychic after. And a lot of the rest of them had discovered that. But they didn't want it mentioned or talked about. And
how do you define psychic? Because we have a multidimensional. Okay.
Yeah, I
so people became more spiritually aware, more intuitive.
As far as I'm concerned, psychic ability is really the enhancement and the acceleration of faculties normal to us. Because you can look at all of your faculties, like, you know, hearing, seeing, and so forth, and you get into the clairs, you know, clairaudience, and putting that little French word preface on the words. But it's really, I truly believe, an expansion and enlargement of faculties normal to us. So, you know, you're able to see further, hear better, pick up things better, know things in advance, that we often call psychic ability that really is, again, it's part of our faculties, but it's our faculties operating on a higher, broader level, which I truly feel our ancestors did. You know, our ancestors were far more intuitive than we are. Most of us have been trained out of it.
Right.
But you know,
so an enhancement of all of our senses, and they're working
absolutely
together more harmoniously.
And that, That's what happens after, well, it's not always harmonious. You know, they just pop up. You have to learn how to control them, refine them. But, yeah, and you know, I want to acknowledge something here, talking about the good old days in back in the 80s and the early research of the near-death experience. I truly feel that the reason I got so much flack from fellow experiencers and even some fellow experiencers, our fellow researchers and even some fellow experiencers back then, and I got a lot of flack. I mean, it was really quite vicious. I was attacked again and again and again. But anyway, I won't go into that except to say that I truly feel the reason for that was that the PhDs and the MDs and you know, the real professional researchers using the scientific method were absolutely dedicated to opening up a field of science dedicated to near-death experiences and what they imply. So because they were so careful and dedicated to establishing that as a field of science, they didn't want someone like me coming in and messing up their theories. You know, I was, well, heaven's sake, I was from Idaho.
Right, this potato picker has an idea that we didn't think of first. How dare she?
Well, you know, in those days, that was before I got my doctorate, in those days, higher education to me was how high you could clear a corral fence when a bull was chasing you. You know, that was higher education.
Okay.
Yeah, the idea of college or university or getting a degree were just totally foreign to my way of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
I knew police work, but the other stuff, you know, just went one ear and out the other. I didn't understand it, didn't know it, didn't have a background in it, any of that. And, you know, I was literally forced into getting some kind of degree and learning a little bit more. But, you know, in those days, they wanted to protect the field, and rightly so. And I was a threat to the field. And, you know, they didn't mean, I don't think any of them really meant to be harmful. It's just one of those things that happen. You know, sometimes you get sort of caught in a scrunch, and you get hurt. And it's more of a misunderstanding, or it's the wrong time, you know, a myriad of reasons. But I truly feel that they did not mean to be vicious. I truly feel they meant to be protective. And I honor them for that. And I feel that was an appropriate behavior at the time. However, at the time, I didn't know that. And at the time, I was really hurt. And it took a while, you know, to understand that.
I really admire your compassion, and you're a really good example for all of us, because we all find ourselves in that position at some point where, you know, we're saying something that isn't what somebody else wants to hear. But you kind of stepped into the wasp's nest, in a matter of speaking, in that...
Oh, boy, did I ever...
Yeah, the near-death experience, one of the things that has amazed me in the conversation and the continuing conflict, which personally, I really feel we all have the advantage of the timing. You mentioned timing on our side, because the truth itself is overpowering the most stalwart in defending what used to be. We'll just call it what used to be. And this is my perception. This is part of the awakening of our consciousness, that we will just not accept anything but truth now. And regardless of people's need to defend what their belief system was, there is a universal truth that underlies all. And that is what people are now truly committed to finding. And the near-death experience has the power to show us unequivocally that we are not our bodies, that we are a consciousness that inhabits the body and has a process here on planet Earth going on. And from there, you have a lot of different words to choose from. I choose the word soul. Our soul's consciousness inhabits the body and begins the journey, which completely alters the paradigm that we have been taught here in this world to this point. And the consciousness of I am my body is easier to manipulate and control for many reasons, because if you are very focused on your body, then you're easier to convince that all you need is food and water. But there's a lot more to the human being, the being of a human. And in your experience walking into this, the biggest curiosity to me is that even to this day, I'm still seeing that they're having a hard time in their material, linear-based scientific model of the birth in the period of I am my body science. We'll just call it that for the conversation. In that paradigm that's material-based, they have a hard time accepting that the near-death experience is a spiritual experience. And that to me is really quite a fascinating place to still be stuck here in 2011, because how could you describe the near-death experience in any other capacity? You know, in an innocent dialogue, as you expressed, yes, in the timing, that was maybe a reasonable ignorance, because it's fair that we're all evolving at the pace that we're evolving. However, to be here now with a plethora of data, both in the available literature and several dockets and dockets in the classified files, that reveal to us clearly there is a spiritual component to our existence. And I think that this can be even evaluated in a much simpler way. You don't even have to have a near-death experience to know that your thoughts are not your body, right? I mean, there's just so many ways to have a very simple understanding that spirit exists. So in your conversation about spirituality and the near-death experience and what defines spirit, would you explain to us what is spirit? How can spirituality be left out of a conversation in evaluating the near-death experience?
Well, you know, when you're talking about MDs and PhDs, they're not trained to handle that word or recognize that reality. So it's not part of their worldview, most of them. It is some, but most of them it is not. And with the near-death experience being established as a scientific field, then they've got to stick with that, and that's what they've done. But I want to say this, that now, just within the last few years, because there's been so much research, really heavy clinical work that has been done. There's been four large clinical prospective studies now done in three countries. We've got another even larger one that's beginning to wrap up. We'll be hearing more about it in the fall of this year and next year. And what they're finding that is truly unrefutable is that during times of no vital signs whatsoever, So no brainwave function, no heartbeat, no breath, no vital signs, whatever. The individual can have a lucid, coherent, detailed out-of-body experience. They have clear, enhanced consciousness. They have self-identity with emotions. They have cognition and thought perception. They have full use of their faculties. They have intact memories. Now, just stop for a minute and realize this is all available without any vital signs. When the brain is not working and there is no activity in the cortex. Now, this is revolutionary, dear. This is absolutely revolutionary. And because it is, the medical world has run up against this solid wall, and they have to open up their eyes and realize that wall isn't solid at all. It's leading to a whole different reality, a whole different way of looking at the human being, a whole different way of looking at consciousness, a whole different way of looking at the human body. So we're talking about a massive turn in very stoic, solid, conservative science and worldviews. So this is just absolutely massive that we've reached that point. Now, having said that, I want to also say that I, like you in that regard, really feel that it's time to bring out the word spiritual and take a look at it. And that's what near-death experiences, the rest of the story, does. In the past, the various researchers or interpreters or philosophers have sort of tiptoed around. They've quoted William James and they've, you know, their favorite philosophers. And again, tiptoed. But none of them have really jumped in and really dug deep. I'm the only one. I'm the first one. And again, my book. In that one, in Near-Death Experiences, the rest of the story, I establish that the near-death experience is not any kind of anomaly, but rather is part of the larger genre of transformations of consciousness. So in the book, I explore what are transformations of consciousness? Why do we have them? Why do we crave them? And where do they lead us? And I know everybody's going to be surprised when they find out what I found out. Because, it's not what you think. And, you know, the first half of the book, up to chapter 16, I complete my research. I say things I never dared to say before. And I do it very slowly. I build it up very, very slowly. People, they're not always recognizing that they're getting new material because I'm building slowly. But eventually they do. They catch on. Well, she's never said this before. Nobody said this before. And then the whole book pivots at chapter 16 because the key is intensity. That's the linchpin in a near-death experience, a near-death-like experience, a transformative spiritual experience, enlightenment. The key is intensity. So from then on, I really jump into that vast pool of the brain, of the deep structures, of spirit, What do we believe? You know, this idea that we're talking about spirituality, well, in near-death experiences, very often people are met by religious figures or angels or spiritual beings, not just loved ones who have died and gone on before. Many times they're met by animals. And so they come back with their stories. And many times these stories will conflict, especially if they're about Jesus or about the church or about religion, anybody's religion, not just Christianity. And these stories will conflict. And very often what they describe about other worlds and, you know, who we are and how we evolve, sometimes that conflicts. We've got something going on right now where we've got this 8-year-old boy who I believe he was 8 when he had his near-death experience, but I'm not really clear on that. But, you know, an 8-year-old boy had a near-death experience. He and his dad wrote a book about it. It sold over 500,000 copies. And you know, you got to really look at this, because this little boy, his father is a pastor. He's raised in the church. He goes to Sunday school, and years and years and years worth. And in his near-death experience, he says to his dad, "It's just like you told us, Dad. It's just like you say in church." You got to look at that. Then we've got this little girl in I think it's Oregon, also had a near-death experience. She's describing the same elements, but she's calling it differently, as if conflicting with him. And you see this over and over and over again, and I really go deep with this in the chapter on biological imperative, in the chapter on the new Christology. You know, we've got to look at what is going on here. And, you know, you have to be careful about how these are described, these experiences. I don't care what kind of experience, the experience. Language constraints is a biggie. Your culture or your belief system before is a biggie. I'm not saying here that you have experiences that complement your belief system. Very often, these experiences absolutely shatter your belief system. But the way we describe them, the words we use, the language we use, will depend on what we're capable of using. And you see that over and over again. We are constrained by what we know and what is in our world. So therefore, we tend to color without meaning to. We often tend to color our descriptions of what we see, what we know, what we face, what we experience. You know, and so, you know, my dad was a cop. You know, he always said, your body says more than your mouth does. So when I'm looking at these people, when I'm studying these people, I didn't just interview people. I study them. I'm an observer. I'm an observer analyst. I'm really looking. And then whenever I could, I'd have them draw pictures. And so I'm really looking at this, and I'm recognizing that these elements, these patterns really hold true. And they hold true internationally. I mean, we're talking about a global event here. But the description will vary. Like, for instance, let's say we're in Thailand. And we have a little kid, 7-year-old kid, who's met on the other side by a greeter. He calls this greeter a Yamatut. Because in his culture, Yama, the lord of the underworld, is served by Yamatuts. And it's the Yamatuts' job to carry out the will of Yama.
Hmm.
So the kid, you know, he doesn't know any other word. He doesn't know the word angel. You know, in Bangkok, Thailand, he's never heard of the word angel. So he uses Yama Toot. You have him draw his picture, and it'll match drawings of a little girl in Wyoming, and someone in Florida, and someone in Israel, and someone in Russia. They are all describing basically the same thing, but they're using the only words they know how to use. So it's when you really sit down with these people and are a complete blank slate and let them paint all over you the color of what they experience. You pay attention to what their body is doing. You pay attention to what their significant others describe as well. You know, what did they notice about their loved one afterward? How have they changed, not changed? And then you really kind of dwell with it. Then you get this larger picture. And this larger picture is so rich and so detailed and so textured that it excites me thoroughly.
Mm.
And it always has, it always will, I'm quite certain, because it's just so incredible, this picture that you get. But you can't go trotting along and just read the stories and hear the pictures or hear the narrative spoken on stage. You got to go a little bit deeper than that. And if you're willing to go deeper, then what the near-death experience reveals is more about life than it does death. And it reveals a life. Well, the most oft-repeated phrase ever used in my research by near-death experiences after their experience was just four words. Always there is life.
Mm.
Now, if you look at those four words, that means there is no afterlife.
Mm.
That means there is no before life.
Mm.
That means there is no now life. That means just life. Always life. In some form, somewhere, in some dimension, we have always existed, we exist now, and we will always exist. And to me, that takes the dynamic of something like a near-death experience and just explodes it all over the map. Because that's what's saying we are not our bodies.
Mm.
That's what's saying we are not our thoughts. That's what's saying we are not what we see and hear and feel and touch. That's what's saying we are powerful. We are intelligent. We are incredibly gifted beings with no limit to what we can ascertain, accomplish, fathom, create, know. That's what excites me. So if you step that down into ideas like, you know, reincarnation, you know, life after life, you step it down into we as human beings on the earth plane and all of our different storylines that we go through, then to me, that's how we form our muscles. This is how we carry out the curriculum that we are given on the other side or in the other worlds or in the other realities. That's where we get our curriculum. That's where we know, but it's here on the earth plane in some type of incarnation this here that we, that the outworking of that curriculum happens. It's here where we get our muscles. It's here that we are able to test what was revealed to us or what we knew in our soul state. And that, to me, makes earth life very important, very special, very privileged, because it's here that we have an opportunity to experience all that can be experienced, and from that grow and learn and stabilize and balance and ascend.
I really appreciate all that you're saying. It's like a balm to my soul to hear you speaking in such clarity and in such tranquility that the road you've traveled has brought you to this place. And the compassion always resounds to all in listening to you. I really appreciate what you're saying, and restoring the joy and the wonder of it all. You know, the near-death experience is an opportunity to do that. And I wonder if we could go here and put the near-death experience into a broader conversation, as you've already been tempting, in the spiritually transformative experience, the transformation of consciousness itself. And in that conversation, the near-death experience, in my experience, is just one of so many ways that
absolutely
our consciousness is transformed, and that these experiences are rife. They're everywhere if we just learn to develop this vocabulary, as you mentioned, that is really a key component, not just in communicating to the world, but in communicating with ourselves, you know,
right,
when we have an experience, you know what I mean?
Absolutely.
We get kind of lost in what the heck was that? And then without having a vocabulary to work with it, even in our own inner dialogue, we can somehow lose the magic in that. And really, I feel like at this point, it's a great thing to expand on and to explore and to broaden. What is a spiritually transformative experience? What is happening to my consciousness? I'm thinking different. I'm feeling different. It's moving through me my whole life, you know? And what is this transformation of consciousness? And so in your experience, how does near-death fit into the broader umbrella of a spiritually transformative experience, and also different levels of spiritual transformative experiences that you find in your research and in your life, maybe that we experience on a daily basis? Because you don't really have to have this level of intensity to have a moment that really changes you.
Well, sure. Any kind of moment can change you. Usually it's something that is surprising or twists you or shifts you around, something that you did not expect. In other words, there's always kind of some type of stress involved. Stress is the major factor, something that stresses you, that either forces you or pushes you to look again and realize, whoops, this isn't working. Maybe there's something else going on here, another truth, another way to do this. Maybe it's time for me to change. And we're all getting a huge dose of that right now, because our economy is changing, our world is changing, our governments are changing, people are changing, everything is changing. And I mean big time. I don't mean just little changes. So we're all getting all kinds of signals and opportunities to relearn things and to create different ways of getting a job, to create different ways of lifestyle, to create different ways of eating and so forth. We're all just we're getting challenges one right after another. So certainly you don't, well, of course you don't have to die to have a transformation of consciousness. Shamanic vision quest, a kundalini breakthrough, baptism, it's often called baptism of the Holy Spirit. Any of these kind of jarring or unusual experiences, sometimes just spiritual rituals that aren't that jarring, but build up over time if you stay with it year after year after year. Sometimes just the desire to be a better person will begin to foster or engender these kinds of changes. And we don't always recognize that we're changing when we do. So there's lots of ways people can change. But when we're talking about these larger changes, these big ones, where suddenly overnight or in a second, your whole world turns inside out, those are all threshold experiences. Every one of them, they're a threshold experience. The idea then that at that threshold or boundary between mind and spirit, sanity and insanity, life and death, there is that thin line, or that particular moment or passageway or threshold experience where you know if you pass through, you'll never be the same again. In mythology, we learn about the watcher at the gate. You know, the gate is always the threshold. And the watcher at the gate is fear, always fear. Sometimes it's symbolized by an animal or a person or an event, but in actuality, it's fear that keeps us from going through that threshold or that passageway. Hmm. And sometimes, often, in near-death experiences, in mythology, in any type of experience, you can be met by a guide of some kind, maybe in your dreams, some type of guide, be it a loved one who's died and gone down before, a special animal, a special being, you know, so forth. You've got this being of some kind or guide of some kind that kind of helps you through or tells you how to get through or at least gives you hints of how you can get through that passageway to the other side. Now, imagine, if you will, being on top of a really tall peaked mountain and you're right there on the peak and some fool comes up behind you and gives you a big shove. And next thing you know, you're out in, you know, thin air. You weren't prepared for that. There's nothing to grab onto. What you believe doesn't make any difference. What you think doesn't make any difference. Calling out for help doesn't matter. You're there. And the only thing you can do is surrender to being there and go wherever it takes you because you have no other choice. Okay, that's the passage through the threshold. When you go through the threshold, it's that kind of experience. There's nothing that can prepare you for moving through that passageway. Mm. And once on the other side, you know, you either slip into madness or, you know, spirit takes over, the soul takes over, and you begin to merge or fly or move into those realms on the other side of the threshold. Now, it's really interesting to me that right now in our world today, we have millions of people going through threshold experiences. Let me talk a little bit more about that in the sense of using the science of fluid dynamics. In the science of fluid dynamics, we are told that it only takes 4 to 5% of any grouping, any situation, any condition to change the entire assembly. So it only takes 4 to 5%, let's say, of a grouping of people. You change them, and you got the whole room. You got the whole group. They'll follow. It's automatic. It's energy. It's sort of like mob psychology, if you want to look at it that way. It only takes a few rabble-rousers. You know, the old idea of it only takes a little bit of yeast to leaven the whole loaf. They all come from the study of fluid dynamics. Okay, 4 to 5% is the tipping point. Right now, today, the conservative, speaking conservative here, this conservative figure in the general population worldwide, so that's not just the United States, worldwide, 4 to 5% have had a near-death experience. Now, that does not count those people who had near-death-like experiences. That does not count people who had spiritually transforming experiences. That does not count people who had transcendent experiences of some kind. So if you open your mind to accept that there's probably a lot of people, then you look at that tipping point of 4 to 5%, and you read on in the science of fluid dynamics, and it tells you more. It says when you are past the tipping point, energy excites and becomes highly charged, and it creates what is called superfluidity. That means that whatever that change was cannot be contained. Look at what is happening now in the Middle East and in Northern Africa. Those people, the protesters, are sounding just like near-death experiencers. They're sounding just like people who have had a transformation of consciousness. They want freedom. They want the freedom to communicate. They want equal rights. They want human rights. They want to have the church or religion of their choice. They want men and women treated equally. They sound just like near-death experiencers because they're being influenced by that same dynamic. This is not going to stop. Doesn't matter how many protesters are killed, this is not going to stop. We're going to see it in every part of the globe. And it's going to pick up, and it's going to get even bigger, which is going to scare every government on this planet because you can't control it. It's going to scare every military contingent on this planet because it cannot be contained. It's going to scare every religion or religious community on this planet because it cannot be contained. It's going to scare every educational institution because it cannot be contained. Our whole planet is changing. It's being turned inside out, not just by the fact that we have passed the tipping point and that there is a revolution of consciousness now happening in the world, but also by the weather. If you want to be astrological, by what is called the Great Shifting. The Great Shifting only occurs once every 25,920 years. We're there. By all kinds of influences coming in from all kinds of places and dimensions. We're getting wrung out, turned around, and challenged in ways we have never been challenged before. We don't have written history that tells us what this was like 25,920 years ago. Mm. We've got relics. Mm. You know, we can do our computer models, but we don't have memoirs.
Mm.
We don't have books. We don't have anything in writing. We don't even have anything in the oral histories that really tells us. Certainly the oral histories in some cultures, like Aboriginal, can tell us a little bit.
Yeah.
But they can't tell us enough to satisfy our modern curiosity. So we are all on the tip of that mountain peak, and we're all getting pushed off. That's why I find research helpful, because it tells us things. It tells us what the after effects are. And if you talk with a lot of people who've gone through this, then you find out ways of handling those after effects, both positive and negative, so that it tells you what to avoid and what to head toward. And you look at anyone who's gone through a lot of challenges, the kinds of things you were talking about before, and those people have a lot to give us. You talk about those teachers who maybe have had some rough knocks in their life. They're going to be really good teachers. Do we all need to be knocked in the side of the head? No, I don't think we do. But we can sure learn a lot from people who have had that happen to them.
Right.
And this is why your program is important, and programs like yours is so important. It's because it introduces what's happening today on various levels, and it's saying there are ways to deal with this that make our lives better and that make our lives more wonderful. And we don't have to spend so much money for it. You know, we can, you can even just go back to maybe the 40s and find out, well, hey, people learned how to sew. And that way they could mend their socks, they could mend their clothes, and they still look pretty good. You know, you can make your own dishes. You can do lots of things yourself. You can bake your own bread. You can learn to do all kinds of things that actually are fun, or at least they can be.
So, absolutely.
You know, to me it's just, there's just so much excitement in this, and I'm looking also right now I'm being attacked again. Yes, I am. You'd say after all these years, people would get tired of it.
You'd really hope
because
so.
Because I have a tendency to just stand here and say, I'm not going anywhere. So if you get on Amazon.com, and you get to the page called Near-Death Experiences, the Rest of the Story, and you go to the bottom of the page. I'm getting screwed again. And the answers to that, the straight talk, the explanation of those people who are objecting so strongly to my book is on my blog. You can just stay on that page, Amazon.com, and about midway on the page on the left-hand side, it's my little picture, and it says something about no more about PMH Atwater, you know, here, access this, and you can get right into my blog right there from the page. Or you can get on my website, which is just myname.com. So it's pmhatwater.com. And you can get right to that particular blog that is straight talk about my research. And you can find what the truth is.
Mm.
And the particular researcher, there was a number of people kind of, you know, made comments that needed a little explanation, and that's in that blog. But this one particular man just really ran me over the coals, and he's been doing it for years, this same man.
Mm.
I don't know. I know the fellow. I know him, and I like him, and I want everybody to know this is a wonderful man. He is. He's a very wonderful man, husband and father. He was a college professor, university professor. I think he taught statistical research. So he's really coming down on me really, really hard. And all I can do is just pray for him because, you know, he's such a, you know, I've hugged him before, I've talked to him before. You can get in the article section on my website, and you could get to the point, to that area where he's attacking another book of mine, Children in the New Millennium. And I got his permission, put all of his objections on there. I mean, I hide nothing. So anybody who wants to know the other story, they can get it easily. And I'm saying to all your listening audience, if they feel so inclined, I truly feel the best way to handle this is to simply put your own review of the book and let it be said what you feel, what you think, what your experience of my book was. In other words, instead of poo-pooing him or coming down about on him, don't do that. I mean, he's a good guy. He's really sincere. He sincerely believes I'm a fraud. He does. He's wrong, but, you know, that's his sincere belief, and I honor that. But I'm just saying, please help me. Put your review on there, and I would appreciate that very, very much. That would be really great.
That's fantastic. Well, in this last dialogue, you offered a great a conversation to encourage the reading of your book for many reasons. This book, The Near-Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story, the recent book that you've written, it gives us a lot of language that we can use for whatever level we might be at in exploring our own spirituality, our own place in the world and how it's changing, being that we are all being pushed off the cliff and we do need to find
We do.
I really appreciate you just putting it right out there. Yes, folks, we have been pushed. And yes, folks, we're going to learn how to spread our wings or we're not. And it will be okay either way because there is something so much greater and really nobody hits the ground who doesn't want to, who doesn't need to. And that's okay too. There's a great lesson in hitting the ground because you put yourself back together and there's nothing greater than knowing you can. So wherever you're going, it's good. It's, I don't mean like good, bad, but it's really where you need to go. We'll just stick with that. So I really appreciated, I've read this book a couple of times. I also read the comments of this gentleman. And when you were listing your group of people, entities that would become fearful, when I read the reviews, I felt like, well, you know, the one, we also need to add, and I think that perhaps this is a very important one to add, is each other. You know, a lot of people, a lot of us will also and are also experiencing a great deal of fear in the change because to have to move from our own personal belief system, even though we probably have known for a long time it's dysfunctional, it does not provide us with happiness, it does not provide us with anything that has fulfilled us and supported growth in the way that we had envisioned ourselves, perhaps, even though we know all of those things, it still changes scary. We don't have the tools, as you said again, that, you know, we don't have a handbook for this time. You know,
well, I'll tell you, prayer and meditation is just wonderful, wonderful skills.
I was going there. Yeah. I was going to ask you about that. In your practice, do you journal? And what are some things that help you stay balanced in this time? And just to close the conversation or to, you know, continue, I want to offer a prayer to everybody who's feeling fearful of the change. And really, only love is real. You know, so I really commend your encouragement of all of us to just be honest and just be from the heart with everybody, you know, whether they're taking time to bash us on blogs or whether we, you know, they're cutting us off in traffic or being extremely rude or whatever, they're caught in fear. And if we can recognize that and love them anyway, I think those of us that can do that can really help everybody move through this change a lot easier.
And, well, I'll tell you, there's nothing more powerful than prayer and meditation. There's absolutely nothing more powerful. I pray and meditate every morning. I pray off and on all day long, and sometimes I'll have little meditations off and on all day long. But the main ones are in the morning. I always read from spiritual literature, I also read from the magazine. It's a little digest magazine called Science of Mind. This Science of Mind teachings come from the writings of Ernest Holmes. He's no longer with us. He's one of the New Thought pioneers. And it's just remarkable, remarkable, wonderful little digest, wonderful little spiritually uplifting articles in it. And then in the middle of this little digest magazine is they call it the Daily Guides for Richer Living, and it's sort of like a sermon for the day each day of the month, and they're really not sermons, but I'm just calling it that. And I read those every morning because that really is helpful to me in connecting with other people, what they observe, what balances them, and how they reach out to people like me in very positive and helpful ways. So that is really helpful to me. Also, I'm also a prayer chaplain, so the idea of prayer for me is a daily dynamic. I mean, it's my day is filled with that. Whenever I hear a siren go by, I immediately invoke divine order that whoever and whatever is involved in that situation are now filled with the light of God and guided to their highest good in accordance with divine order. So I say something like that every single time I hear a siren. I consider myself to be a part of this world. So everything that's in this world, I address in some way. And I choose to do that recognizing that there are many faces, there are many degrees of energy, degrees of awareness, degrees of consciousness, and that they all have their place. It's sort of like life is a great big school, and some of us are still in kindergarten. Some of us are doing graduate work. Some of us are here on recess. You know, I mean, just think of it as this great big school, and so therefore you're not so apt to judge anybody,
right?
Because you realize, well, maybe they're taking nursery school over for the second or third time. That doesn't mean you have to put up with what they do. That doesn't mean you have to like what they do. But we're right. challenged to love them.
Right.
That's our
right.
challenge. We are not challenged to like anybody or put up with anybody, but we are challenged to love them.
Right.
And what we're loving is that essence of them, that soul of them, that spirit, that fire, that sparkle in them that is God's gift.
Mm.
So that's what we're loving. And I find myself really challenged lately, as I'm sure everybody is, with Osama bin Laden. You know, we finally got the monster. He's dead. And I'm looking at Hitler because my life was so impacted by Pearl Harbor mm-hmm. and World War II. And I was very much imprinted by that. It just had a lot to do with my early years. Just to give you an idea of how impacted I was, I lived in Twin Falls, Idaho then, a relatively small town. And there were a lot of people in our town that were killed in the war effort. And in those days, if a family lost someone in the war effort, they were given a very large gold star decal. And you put that decal in your living room window so everyone could see what the sacrifice was and that you were part of the war effort and someone in your family died defending our country. So it was a point of pride. Well, so I lived then in the town, and I had to walk to first grade, the elementary school, and I had to walk along Shoshone Boulevard, and it was a real boulevard, the homes on either side, and it was like, I don't know, 9 or 10 blocks or so that I had to walk. And the blocks were like New York City blocks. I mean, big blocks, not mm-hmm. like little blocks. They were huge blocks. And on either side of the street, there were gold stars in many of the homes in their windows.
Mm-hmm.
And this one particular morning, there were 6 new gold stars overnight in this person's window.
Mm.
And I just froze, and I sobbed, and I sobbed, and I sobbed. I don't remember a single morning in all of my first grade when I didn't have to quiet my shutters and stop my sobs just to walk in the door of my classroom.
Mm.
It was a time in our country, certainly when we were unified, very, very much so, but people sacrificed heavily. You know, rationing, air raid drills, you know, butter was rationed, sheets were rationed, gas was rationed. Our grocery store, where we went, you brought the food from your victory garden, and you went to the grocery store, and it was part canning kitchen, and you would go in there and can your veggies from your victory garden, and then you would pick whatever you could from the shelves, and the shelves were very sparse. And then when you'd go to the cashier, you would pay for the 10 of your cans, and then whatever else you picked. So it was a different way of getting groceries.
Interesting.
And so I grew up with that trauma, and I mean it was trauma city.
Mm.
Woo.
Mm.
And I could go on about that, but I won't. Except to say that when Hitler was killed, and we've got a lot of conspiracy theorists who say he wasn't killed and he went to live in South America because they never found his body.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me like they did find his body. But anyway, as far as I'm concerned, Hitler was killed. And, of course, you know, everybody, hip hip hooray, you know, everybody's screaming and yelling and so glad, you know, that the monster's gone. Of course, in that time, his death ended the war in the sands of Europe, at least. With Osama bin Laden being killed, that doesn't end our conflict with terrorism. So it's a little different, but yet it's still the same thing of you've got a lot of emotion in involved with this. You've got there's a real big investment here of your passion, your strength, your blood, your feeling, and someone that you regard as the epitome of evil has just been killed. So how do we handle that?
Well, what I think is interesting... Sorry.
Well, I was just going to add here that maybe a good way of handling that is to acknowledge relief. We're relieved. We are. Let's be honest. We're relieved. But I don't feel that celebrating that relief is necessary. You can yell and scream if you want, and then be done with it. Because that being, that person had a role. They had a role to play in this world. And you can argue good, bad, or indifferent, but they still had a role to play. And I look at that and I say, I'm not to judge that. I don't have to like it. I can say, oh, thank God he's gone. But I can also bless the spirit, the soul that really encompassed that man. And I can say, you are now where you need to be. Whatever you need to handle or make right, you will. Whatever you came here to do is now accomplished. You are now on your journey back to God, Allah, deity. And in that way, I can recognize the spiritual component. And it's in that way that I think we can recognize the spiritual component with all of our demons, with all of our attackers, with all of our bulliers, with all the hostile beings that we meet. They have a purpose of some kind. You know, let me just really be really, really quick here. I was downtown Washington, D.C. I was getting off of an elevator. A lot of people were getting off of at this elevator. There was a black guy trying to get on the elevator. He was getting pushed and pushed and elbowed. And I could see, you know, I'm an observer, and I'm watching his muscles. And I could see him tightening. I could see his face tightening. I could see him getting angry because no one was honoring his presence. So I went up to him and I said, thank you so much for waiting for the rest of us to get off this elevator. I just think that was really kind, and I just want to thank you for that. That's all I said. And the guy smiled, and his shoulders dropped, and his fist opened, and his face sparkled, and then he got in the elevator. You know, that's all it takes, Jamil, is to just recognize the moment. We don't have to judge it. Just recognize the moment and meet the moment on its own terms. Don't prejudge what that term is. Meet the moment on its terms.
Well, I really appreciate you saying that. And your book does a really good job. That's the whole point of the book, is to ask the bigger questions. why do these things happen? And what is the moment's message? What are the lessons to be learned? And it's personal. And I appreciated that in your book as well. You make it really clear that this is a personal experience, that we are human beings having these experiences that are directly connected to our lives. And war is something that is a signature of this planet, has been for however long, and is something that impacts every one of us, regardless of what storyline we're following or what the significance is. What you have just shared with us is another transformation of consciousness in the idea that what it's implicating on a few levels is that the person, there isn't a person, one person. There isn't a person that is a face of evil. You know, the question of war is something personal. We all have to look at the war inside of all of us and our own capacity to love ourselves and our place in it and how this emanates from us. There's really no terrorist to catch. There's only a terrorist of how we treat ourselves. And if we can get that and understand the lessons being offered in the moment of our own lives, we will just simply outgrow our taste for blood and guts and gore and death. I mean, from World War II to now, the conversation of war has transformed on many levels. I mean, to the point where we don't even question war now on certain levels. We've become numb now. In your time, the awareness of war and its atrocities were prominent. Here in my time, I'm 48 this year, there's been nothing but war. The U.S. has been engaging in war somewhere my whole life. This has never brought unity to the country. This has never brought, for me personally, any sense of pride or sense of accomplishment. It never ends. There's only another person to kill, another something to kill, to kill, to kill, to kill. And so why are we celebrating death? So I'm really glad you touched that, because it's much more meaningful to say this person, whoever this person is, that represents a figure that holds an energy for us of hatred and evil, has a place. Everything has a place. Every person has a place. Our attackers, and you said this, and I loved this, in one of the interviews that you had that I listened to, I wrote it down. You gave us the lessons that you've learned. And one of them was about your attackers and showing us the lessons we need to learn about ourselves. And those four things you said were just so, so cool. Do you have those with you?
I think those are here in a file.
I'm searching my blog for it too. If you would like to share with us those lessons,
Think that they're not written anywhere yet. I choose not to write it down. But here's what I've learned from being a near-death researcher and putting up with all that I put up with, and for them putting up with me. You know, it goes both ways. It's not just me suffering, but it's the other people suffering because of me, because I tend to be a little scratchy and, you know, a little bit to the point, and I don't always understand other people's styles, and, you know, sometimes I'm like a bull in a china shop. I try not to be that way, but I know sometimes I have been that way, and that people have been very disgusted with me. So recognizing that there are two sides to the coin, here's my side.
Okay.
I learned that facing my attackers and talking with them works wonders and solves most of the problems between us, plus it saves everyone a lot of money. I learned that what my attackers have done, they did out of fear. Fear that I would not credit their work and honor their sacrifices. I learned that any new idea or unique method or finding is an automatic flag for attack. No one wants a newcomer messing up their theories. I learned that a long walk on the dark side is good for you. It keeps you humble and helps you to find different ways to accomplish what you want to do. I learned that your attackers are the best gift God could ever give you, for they keep you honest and enable you to learn what you need to know about yourself. Bless what hurts. That's just your soul trying to catch your attention. Bless the peace that follows listening to your soul.
Yes. Thank you very much for sharing that with us all. I think there's just a lot we can meditate with that and really take that in. I wonder, do you ever do anything, a couple of things. How do you define meditation? Like you said, reading, but do you have a component? Is that it?
Well, yeah.
Do you define meditation as you read, or how do you define, because meditation is a big, we have a thousand, you know, how do you define meditation?
Lots of ways of meditating.
Yeah.
Prayer is where you talk to God. Meditation is where God talks to you. In other words, shut up. When I meditate, I go to a different level of consciousness. I do that by breathing. I do that by holding my fingers in a certain way. And when I get to that level of consciousness that I want to get to, it feels very different. It's not like my regular conscious mind. It has a very different feeling to it. Mm-hmm. I truly feel like I have ascended or left my body or something very much akin to that. Now, when I reach that level, a lot of people blank out into nothing, or they will tone, or they will repeat in their mind a certain mantra. And that's okay. I have done that kind of meditation, and that's fine. But remember, I'm a prayer chaplain. So mm-hmm. when I reach that level, I begin to affirm healing for others. And I go through them. Then I let go of that. And I affirm the divine order of life's privilege to breathe and to exist and to have what we call life. So in that sense of gratitude, I dwell for a while. And then when I come out, I always come out by a little prayer, prayer protection going in, a prayer protection coming out, and restart my body and my mind in regular functioning. Then after I do that, I do facial exercises, I do body exercises, I do a number of different types of exercises, and then I come downstairs and eat my breakfast. Before I go into meditation is when I do my spiritual reading, and I read from three different texts. One of them is the Science of Mind magazine. One of them is kind of like a book of thoughts and affirmations. And the other one, and I'm trying to remember the name of it, it's by Eknath Eswaran, and it's a new book. It's an anthology of some of the world's most beautiful spiritual poems and phrases, not just phrases, but, you know, kind of like renderings of some kind. It's just a beautiful, beautiful book. Eknath Eswaran was one of my original teachers in meditation. He was a professor at Berkeley in California. He came from India. And he was trained by his grandmother. His grandmother was his guru. And he was a very practical, down-to-earth person who knew how to explain things and talk about things in such a way that it really made sense. And he was just exquisite. I learned from his LP. He put out an LP at that time, a record. And he did a lot of translating. And so he translated the Upanishads and, you know, a lot of different Indian texts. But he didn't have the countenance of the typical guru from India. Rather, he was like this very soft, warm, friendly guy next door who you knew his soul. And there was just something very special about Eknath Eswaran. And he founded the Nilgiri Press, and they still do publish a lot of books. See, what's the name of that book? God, something about rivers run through it. God makes the rivers run through it, or something like that. You might kind of Google Eswaran, Eswaran, I believe, Aren. Eknath is Eknath, Eknath Eswaran. You might kind of Google it, something about the rivers, God makes the rivers run through it, or something like that. And it's fabulous. Mm. So I do that. And then throughout the day, I'm open to the world talking to me. My walls talk to me. The food blender talks to me. The grass talks to me. The trees talk to me. Wherever I am, there's a lot of conversation, and I listen.
Mm-hmm.
So from meditation for me, prayer and meditation for me are life itself. It's breathing.
So I
have my formal time, but I have my everyday, every moment time. There's no way I can hold this telephone right now and not be just alive with the privilege of being able to hold this telephone. And to be able to talk to you through the magic of electronics and feel you and hear your voice and then hear all the sounds in the air around me singing. And it's just fabulous just to put one foot in front of the other. And to just realize that you're Juliet's daughter, you know, it's like, you know, I love Juliet. She passed on to other levels. But you're here. Mm-hmm. And you are you. You're not Juliet. You're not her in any way, shape, or form.
No, I'm not.
But you're part of that essence. And I just think that's a lovely thing to be.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for mentioning my mom, Juliet Nightingale. She's who gave me this seat here on bbsradio.com and who introduced me to you. And all those years ago, actually, we had a lovely encounter back in New York.
Yes, we did.
And what a gift that is. And what you're speaking is the language of gratitude, that every moment, every breath is a celebration that it happens at all.
Oh my God. Look,
I just breathe. Wow.
Well, it is. It is. To me, breath is just so incredibly special. And I just feel so privileged to be alive in a body breathing on the earth plane. You know,
yeah.
A lot of people want to be spiritual. Well, hey. spirituality is life. It's who you are. It's that which enlivens you. So, you know, you don't have to get spiritual. All you need to do is recognize that you are spiritual.
Thank you. Yes. Yes, it's that simple.
Yes, it is.
Oh, my God, but don't we have to read 1,000 books and memorize and get PhDs that say we are? Come on, you're screwing me up, PMH. No?
Well, you know, you can do all that, and I'd appreciate it if you'd read some of my books. But then you need to also realize that everything that you're reading is in you. And what they're talking about is what you are. So it's taking it then from the mind mental and bringing it into the body feeling and connecting with what that is. And what that is spirit. And what spirit is soul. And what soul is presence. And what presence is the one. You know, near-death experiencers talk about oneness. Most of them don't realize that that has a name. It's called the perennial philosophy. The perennial philosophy is very, very old. It goes back to the time of Plato. But it didn't really take on the name of the perennial philosophy until the 1800s. And it's, the perennial philosophy is one God, one people, one family, one existence, one law, which is love, one commandment, which is service, one solution to problems, which is forgiveness. When you have a threshold experience, if you are able to make it through the passageway in one piece, you always encounter oneness on the other side. That perennial philosophy is what is on the other side of the threshold.
Wow, thank you so much. Can you believe it? We are closing down our 2 hours, friend. It's a lovely, lovely, lovely note to close on. And we would like to encourage people again to visit your website, pmhatwater.com. Check out her book, Near Death Experiences, The Rest of the Story. It focuses on what they teach us about the experience, about who we are, gives us invaluable lessons of our humanity, of our experience in the oneness of who we really are and who we are becoming. And that I like to take from what you just said, that we are bringing that oneness here. That there's no reason why not. We can have that and live life on planet Earth in oneness and really get down and start doing some other kind of creating besides what we've known, which has its value. And we can thank all the people who are playing all of their parts, thank them and love them, and try to avoid their arrows if we possibly can, and help each other stay strong in this, because we really need each other. And those would be my closing comments. Would you like to offer any closing comments, PMH? We've got about 2 minutes.
I've got 2 minutes. My goodness. Just realize that the near-death experience reveals more about life than it does death. And what it reveals is how dynamic and lively all aspects of life are, and that life really is worth its living. Absolutely, it's worth its living. I'm very glad that I'm here. I'm wearing a body, and I say thank you, God.
I'm really glad you said that. In particular, I met up with somebody this week who was just, I think this is, a lot of people are wondering why they are wearing their body, and I'm really glad that you said that. So, thank you so much for joining me here on the Alchemy Podcast. Bless your beautiful, beautiful heart, PMH. Long may you fly, long may you ride, and just thank you. And this is Jameel Graham, and thank you all, the listeners, for joining us, and I hope you've enjoyed it as much as we have, and please do take care of yourselves and each other. Until next time.